Hello everybody and welcome to Patriotic Weekly Review, episode number 360. We're live tonight on Rumble, Odyssey, DLive and Entropy. Please do share the links because we've got a great show coming up for you. And I've got a good friend of mine joining me tonight to talk about the state of politics in Europe after the Hungarian election, which has seen populist poster boy Viktor Orban dumped out on his backside in the most humiliating way imaginable. Not something that I think a lot of people would have predicted, but something that's actually part of a pattern. We saw a contraction in the number of people voting for the populist right in Holland, with Geert Wilders seeing a reduction in the number of seats he held in Parliament at the end of last year. I thought that was a bit of a blip, but things don't seem to be going well. And how will that affect us? Well, we're discussing that very shortly. Now, I've got a lot of things happening this week. I have a lot of things happening every week. I've already done a show with Dr. Patrick Slattery. That is out every Monday. I'll be sharing that more. I'm going to put a full schedule of my work, my regular work, up on my Telegram and Gab so people can see how much I'm doing and where to find it. Now, that's already been done. I'm doing this show, obviously, tonight. I have a show with Dr. David Duke tomorrow afternoon, 4 p.m. UK time, if he's in good health and he's not at the doctor's as he was last week. I then have a stream with Thomas Sewell discussing everything that's happening in the world and in Australia on Friday, but that will be at 9 p.m. So there's going to be a good stream there. And on Sunday, we have our film club. I also have started a Substack and I am putting regular writings out there because it's easier for me to get my thoughts out there in written format than it is for me to produce the traditional videos I used to do. I'm very busy. I don't have much time. And the time I do have is taken up with the family. So I've decided to start a Substack. You can find me there. The links are on my Telegram and Gab. I've already written 3 articles for my Substack and I'm writing them at the rate of about 1.5 per week. So please do check those out if you can. And please subscribe to me there. It's a good place to get up-to-date thoughts. And I've done a big article about the Hungarian elections, around 2,000 words. So check that out if you can. Now, if you like all that work, if you like what I do, please support my work. It means a lot to me if you can. I know times are hard for people. And I know that donations across the board for people seem to be a little bit down. But please, if you can afford to give something, it is appreciated. You can give via Entropy. You can give via Odyssey. No, you can't. You can't give via Odyssey. You can give via Rumble. Everything is very, very gratefully received. I haven't been getting many Entropy donations. I don't know if something's wrong with it. Some people have fed back, said they've had trouble logging in, etc. I know other creators have had problems with that. We've been through that before. But if you can give something, it would be appreciated. $3, $5, $10, whatever you can afford. And we will answer any questions in depth in the second hour of the show. Remember, if you're watching this on replay, you can at any time donate through Entropy. You can gift at any time through Entropy. It's very easy to do that. And it is what keeps my head above water. Obviously, if people can donate more generous sums, that is very, very much appreciated. You can also donate via crypto. All the crypto links are in the description below. And finally, you can write to me at mark@thefallofwesternman.com. So please do consider giving a donation and we will answer those in the second half of the show. Tonight, I'm joined by my good friend, Sasha. I've met him in real life on a number of occasions. He's a true beast of a man. You can actually see how big he is on the screen. But there are pictures of... There's actually a really funny picture because there's a picture of me next to Blair. And Blair looks massive compared to me. And then Sasha is also in the frame. And he's even bigger than Blair. So I kind of look like a child next to this guy. He's a true hero of the German people. And do you know what? I actually hate German politics. And I hate German politics because I see all these AfD sellouts and people floating around, going to remigration summits and things like that. But they all ignore this man. And this man, to me, is the most honest, hard-working and honourable man in German politics. If somebody said to me tonight, pick the next leader of the German nation, it'd be this guy. He's a family man. He's an honest man. Every time I've come across him in real life, and I've met him numerous times, he is one of the politest, kindest, and most well-spoken people you could hope to be with. He's a real gentleman. He's just released a book in both English and German. He's going to tell you a little bit about that first, but not too much because next month we'll be reviewing that in full on the return of Book Club. This month we're reviewing Sam's book, next month Sasha's book. But he's a great guy, so please do follow him. Please do subscribe to him wherever you can. And please do purchase his book, which is available in both English and German. Sasha, how have you been? Tell us a bit about your book, and then we'll get into the big issues of the day.
Thank you for this extraordinary, kind introduction. You're really a champion in introducing a show, and that's the best prerequisite to have a guarantee that every show will be a huge success. Yes, I'm very busy too, because I published a new book in not just in the German language of my mother tongue, but also in the there's also an English version published now, and that makes sense because that book is about our cultural Occidental heritage. So there is a regard to more than just my own country. It's called, maybe one can see it here, it's called Culture, Aesthetics, Identity, the Blossoms of the Occidental World. And I cover in that book the highlights, the cultural highlights of the Occidental world regarding the sections of music, literature, architecture, painting, and those fine arts from the perspective of their relevance regarding identity and identitarian aspects and feelings. And there's a lot of the cultural art history and cultural achievements from the English-speaking world, in particular from Britain, in that book during the chapters. So I can imagine that it's for one who is interested in culture, that is especially for an Englishman, for a British man or woman, interesting to read. And I'm looking forward to making, and I'm very glad and grateful getting that opportunity to promote this book in an extra show next month or so, and to talk a little bit more about what I've written in that. And otherwise, I'm already writing on a next book, which will be a little bit more, I think, in regarding the volume, which will touch it's about the decade we are living in, because that decade started with a caesura in 2020 when this corona pandemic started, which was a huge acceleration in particular societal transformation programs. And that was in the beginning of that decade. And we come close to the end of that decade, where one of the most known global feudalist agendas shall be, presumably, the establishment tried to shall to finish it. It's the Agenda 2030. And in a review, what happened, what is planned in that regard, and what happened since 2020, and what we have to expect in regard of 2030, and how to behave through the relevant issues. I'm writing a book on that topic already, so I'm also always very busy and writing a lot and making my speeches and everything, but it's always a highlight being at Patriotic Weekly Review.
Well, it's always great to have you here, and especially when there's big things happening in Europe. Now, I said I've released a very, very lengthy, well, very, very lengthy, but a lengthy article on my Substack about the Hungarian election results. But you and I have been doing this a long time, you longer than I have. But we've reached this point where we've seen this rise in anti-immigration sentiment, and that has manifested with these populist right parties. We've had the Trump movement, which I think it's fair to say is the global centre of the populist right. Trump has been seen as almost the populist right boogeyman or hero, depending on what side of the political fence you're sitting on, all over the world. He has been connected to people like Viktor Orban. I mean, he sent J.D. Vance over to campaign with Viktor Orban for this upcoming election. And what we're seeing here now, in my humble opinion, is a contraction of the populist right. The populist right, which started with a lot of hope and a lot of people believing it was going to go places, has now been marred with sleaze, corruption, foreign wars, support for American imperialism, support for Zionism. And we're not just seeing a contraction across certain European countries, but we're seeing in places like Hungary the complete implosion of the populist right, and a populist right poster boy being unceremoniously dumped with a very, very humiliating election result. And this was with the backing of Trump and J.D. Vance and the American administration. And my big concern here, Sasha, is the anti-immigration movement has been tied to people like Wilders, Trump, Orban. And with them failing, we're actually seeing at this critical, this sort of 11th hour, the one thing we wouldn't want to see, people moving away from the anti-immigration message to return to more centrist politics, because populist right figureheads have fundamentally fumbled the ball, whether deliberately or just through sheer stupidity, and have essentially maybe set us back, what, half a decade or a decade, at a crucial time when the demographic shifts, if they're not reversed now, they'll be irreversible. So it's kind of like we're in the 11th hour, we're in injury time. It's like we've got to win the game now or else it's lost. And these idiots have just scored an own goal. What are we seeing here? And what do you think the ramifications will be of the economic instability caused by Trump? And to a degree, I mean, there was economic instability in Hungary due to the things that Orban did. And he was very corrupt as well. People despised the way he was doing business there, the way he was giving contracts to all his mates. This isn't what we were hoping for. Firstly, what's your take on it? And then we'll discuss whether we think this is going to taint other groups and have a wider effect across Central Europe and Western Europe.
What we have seen here, I think that is the result when the voter is based only on wishful thinking, due to the fact that a lot of these red-pilled newcomers had been red-pilled very recently and stumbled into the political arena without any experience. And the voter didn't see, or the voter didn't have the capacity to differentiate what are core values and what are simply campaign slogans. And populist movements oftentimes didn't share the same core values as genuine nationalists do, or mostly overwhelmingly they grew very fast to success, and by that gained a huge support, but a very, as I said just recently, a red-pilled support. So they had a very inhomogeneous structure. And nearly all those populist movements lack an ideology, and a political theory. And they lack, because of the success, they thought they don't need that political theory, that ideological foundation. And by thinking not not needing that foundation. They didn't build up a metapolitical sphere, a forefield, other political cultural circles, and so standing only on one pillar, that of populism, makes it possible to fail. And on the other hand, the general voter concentrated, focusing on his daily problems on the domestic level. Most of the voters are not very skilled or even very interested in analyzing foreign politics or geopolitical strategies. And if they voted the populists expecting a change, a political change, and but experiencing afterwards nepotism and corruption, and as presumably there is still, or was, and is still a high degree of nepotism and corruption also in Hungary, then it's only a question of time. And he was in power 16 years. That's a long time. Maybe he should have chosen another phase of his party, to a fresh phase as a leader, because a little bit it is not yes, it was a landslide victory. So I wouldn't excuse it only because of interventions from Brussels and everything else. It was a landslide victory, but not in that way as the parliamentary seats would suggest. If you do a look regarding the voting system in Hungary, and if you look what was the the proportional the list, and if you look on the constituents, where is the first past the post, and he lost at this mostly due to this on the constituent level where the first past the post system is. If you look at the proportional part of this electoral system, it was, I think, Tisza won with 52% or 53%. It's still a landslide victory, but not that huge miracle as the parliamentary seats will suggest. And given additionally that we don't know what that party or what Peter Magyar really wants, because he didn't explain it during the campaign. It was part of a strategy, not to explain, I assume. So it will be interesting if we will see is Soros come back, or if he tries to hold or stick to a little bit of a nation state self-determination, and only tries to play the Brussels game a little bit better than Orban. But looking to what kind of people have been the first congratulating, I think we have to fear there is the danger of a Soros comeback in Hungary.
You see, what gets me initially, the first thing that sort of struck me with the Hungarian result, other than the sort of overwhelming majority and the massive turnout. So, you know, for one party to win a two-thirds majority or greater, which gives them the ability to change the constitution, is massive. But also for that party to win such a large majority with such a high turnout does suggest that there has been a complete sea change of opinion against Orban. But Orban was most notably anti-NATO and anti-EU. And one thing that's always disgusted me is when I see European people running into the arms of the European Union. And if you look at the people who were celebrating this, all of the people we hate, all of them, if you name one repugnant European Union politician, you can be sure that they will have been celebrating this. Ursula von der Leyen is the number one, and she is literally doing a little victory dance right now. And plenty of American liberals, Obama, Clintons, they're all celebrating this too. And this is going to take the Hungarian people back towards EU control. Now, I know Orban did a lot of bad things, but by sort of pushing the EU away from Hungary and denying the EU the ability to send migrants and refugees to Hungary, that was a major thing. And that was something that was cheered all over. That was something that people supported. But this will undoubtedly immediately do two things. Firstly, it will end the veto on more money being sent to Ukraine. So there's going to be tens of millions more pumped into Ukraine. Then you're also going to see the sort of freedom of movement and refugee resettlement continue in Hungary. And when you see someone taking over and they haven't truly telegraphed what they're going to do, but they're being applauded by your Donald Tusks, your Keir Starmers, your Ursula von der Leyen's, you know, your American Clinton elite, you get a pretty good idea that the people that are celebrating their victory have already spoken to this new leader and know what they're going to get. They will be more on the pulse than we are. And I see this as a major negative, but I think it is a sign of the times. And unfortunately, Orban did mess up. There was incredible corruption. There was still lots of legal migration going into Hungary. There was a cost of living crisis there. And this is something I put in my article. And this is something very important. And I'm sure you'll know this too, because how long have you been doing this, Sasha? How long have you been doing like the nationalist politics?
My first public speech in the hometown here where I'm living, I held in 1991, 18 years young.
So you got involved 9 years before I did. So you've been doing this for about 35 years. I've been doing this 26 years. And I'm sure you've heard many times that our time will come when the cost of living rises, when there's an economic collapse, when there's massive inflation, when there's uncertainty, and people can no longer afford to sit and ignore big issues such as immigration. And this whole theory is underpinned by an assumption. And that assumption is that fundamentally, when the economic turmoil and collapse comes, it will come under a centrist, liberal or left-leaning government. However, what if the economic turmoil comes under a populist right government, which has just happened in Hungary? Now, at that point, you see this charge back to a centrist position, this charge back to NATO, the EU, the sort of, you know, post-Second World War consensus. People start hugging it again, which is what, and we want people to reject the post-Second World War consensus. That's the central battle that we have, to get people to reject that. And now what you've got, because of Trump's absolute treacherous evil and what he's doing in Iran, is you're risking a global recession. And the man that's brought it about, again, is somebody who is tied to the populist right. And I see that driving people away and making the populist right toxic. And I know that certain nationalists will say, well, this will be a good thing because loads of people will instead flock to real nationalism, to ethno-nationalism. This will be our in. The populist right will fall and everybody will come to us. But that doesn't seem to be happening. what actually seems to be happening is people are going back to the center. And in America specifically, and we've got a generous super chat about this that we will talk about a bit later in the second half of the show, is people are going to be running back to the Democrats. They're going to be running back to the woke, liberal, pro-migration party that they just voted out. Now, the interesting thing here is this isn't what we hoped for. We hoped for an economic collapse under either a centrist or woke left-leaning government so that we could benefit from it. But no one ever assumed that there would be this sort of populist soft right that would lead to these problems and potentially at the 11th hour drive everyone back towards the center. And we know this. We know this is something that was on the cards because we saw this in France. I remember reading the data from the most recent round of French elections, and it said that the whitest section of the population, the over 60s, were the least likely to break with the old parties. And they were least likely to break with the old parties because they were the ones that feared instability the most. They wanted to live out their days with their pensions, their savings, their house, and they thought the best way to do that was to keep voting for the status quo. They were the ones least likely to vote for Marine Le Pen, which goes against everything that normal people think. People think, well, you know, people are going to vote for Le Pen because, you know, over 60s will vote for Le Pen because they want to take it back to a better time. They don't. They want to hold on to what they've got and live out their days in peace without the turmoil of ripping everything up and having a radical come in. But this is an issue, isn't it? If we were just getting the most resistant people to start, you know, dipping their toe in the extreme waters of the populist right, and now they're all being frightened back to the center, how far can this go? Because unfortunately, I would say in Britain, we have about 25 years left until about 2050 before we become a minority. In America, it's about 2040. And I'd say France and Germany, give or take a year or two, probably about the same as Britain. So if at this 11th hour, people are sort of frightened away from the anti-immigration movement due to economic problems caused by populist right figureheads, is this going to be what the establishment needs in order to run down the clock and make sure that the last few years where it is actually viable for us to make a big change are wasted because people like Orban, Trump and Geert Wilders have messed things up so royally?
I think, unfortunately, I do think that. I think we have to leave the impression, which is somehow a communist view in that regard, assuming a linear development. And I think there will not, definitely not be a linear development somehow to a situation that will mirror former times. You can't turn back the wheel of time, and we have to face some realities which make that impossible. What I strongly believe is that we still have not seen the, how to say it paradoxically, the peak of the low, the mess. The mess will be the shambolics will much more increase. And demography's destiny, and hoping that you change that in votes, and the populist and the conservative scaredy cat right wing will always make the mistake to join a coalition with the center, and by missing making the essential demands which a political change, a paradigm change would require. And if you see the demography's destiny, if you see that situation, we should not rely exclusively on that voting systems. Take a simple arithmetic. If you have, for example, 100 Brits, Brits. And after 20 or 25 years from this 100, 25 are from Africa. But you still would need 51 voters to make this paradigm shift. But you then you need that 51 voters from the 75 Brits left. So we have an arithmetical problem, and so I think it's nearly impossible to change the system, which doesn't have just a mistake, but is the mistake to change such a system within the system. That won't work, and we will face that situation of a Weimarization, of a shambolic reality of parliamentarism with an economic depression. We only can hope that that depression, that the hardships in course of such a depression will coerce somehow our people to stick together and to become aware that communities will be needed in a situation which more and more will tribalize, but not in a peaceful manner. And I think we can't imagine now, we really lack the crystal ball, how that future will look like, because it will definitely not be comparable to everything we hitherto have seen. It will be completely different. And it was a huge mistake that the ones who had the chance to initiate a paradigm shift on a higher level lacked the prowess to do so. And Orban, for example, was 16 years in power. And there had been times where before Donald Tusk in Poland, where they in the Visegrad Straits, where they had a strong bloc, very skeptical and critical to the EU Commission in Brussels, and you and now at times it's very lonely around Robert Fico from the Slovakia, the last stronghold left in the lurch by all the mistakes of the others, and the problem was that they didn't have the prowess Great Britain had with the Brexit. Nevertheless, Britain didn't make anything out of it. Britain didn't use the opportunities it were given by that Brexit, but that's on another page. But all those EU skeptics, they were a kind of semi-exiteers. They wanted to play, to game the system, to get a little bit of the money, to criticize, to make populism on the domestic sphere. But they never opposed full force. They could have ended the European Union if at the time when Great Britain decided the Brexit, when back then Hungary also had said, "Thank you. That's a good role model. I make a phone call to Robert Fico in Slovakia. I make a phone call to Poland. I make a phone call to the Czechia, and let's end this shambolic Brussels system." But they didn't do that. And if you hear one of the first things I read was that Peter Magyar received the demands. I think it was the Financial Times writing that 27 demands from the European Commission for Peter Magyar immediately after his election, and he wants to have the withhold money. But Hungary survived up to now without that money that had been withheld. And what, for example, in 2024, Hungary received only 2 billion in the year 2024 from Brussels. 2 billion. That's not a reason to sell my nation state self-determination for 2 billion. When otherwise having the problems on the energy sector because they forbid you to make your deals with Russia. Okay, they did a little bit, and we will see what Peter Magyar will do with the energy architecture and the arrangement agreements with Gazprom and Rosatom, because he will have some problems because Orbán is still here as an opposition leader, and he will have the problems because. Look at the biography of this Peter Magyar. I'm very suspicious. We have read things that he had beaten up women or so. I don't know if it's true or it's not true. So, but it's I don't know what take I should have about that person. But nevertheless, his ex-wife was the Minister of Justice under Orbán, Varga. He was in the same party as Orbán, and Orbán was in power 16 years and had also had good votes. So the Hungarian people, which are not infiltrated by mass immigration as our countries are, they don't have this woke alignment like the Left EU Commission. So it will be interesting how to see how he will be able to handle this. On the one side, the required pragmatism, not to disappoint his voters in Hungary, versus the expectations of Brussels. But in the end, that won't change anything. What I've explained the sentences before, that we will see a completely new situation in, I think, within the next decade, or even earlier.
Thank you. Well, look, let's move on to Trump, because I think it's fair to say he has completely shot it now, and it's likely he's not coming back from this in terms of public perception. But you tend to see politicians have a variety of different meltdowns and do pretty stupid stuff. But I don't think in my entire life I've seen a sitting politician, well, not one that's that high ranking anyway, certainly not like a national leader or a president, post a picture to social media suggesting that he is the modern reincarnation of Jesus. Now, that is not only narcissistic and, well, it's insane, isn't it? To, you know, even if you were to think that, surely you've got some filter where you think, well, maybe I shouldn't post that to social media. Maybe that's the one thing that shouldn't go on social media. Even if I think that about myself, even if somebody's made a graphic suggesting that, I shouldn't like it or repost it because it looks narcissistic. It makes me look like a complete fool, like I've gone completely insane, like I think I'm bigger than just a man, bigger than a politician. Now, he believes essentially that he is the second coming of Christ. But also, you're going to offend a lot of people, and you're going to offend your core voter base, because people who generally voted for Trump would be described as WASPs, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. It was almost like the last hurrah of the white man, the last hurrah of the descendants of those who founded and built America, voted in Trump this second time. But here we are, Donald Trump, the man who believes he can do no wrong, the man who has broken almost every promise he's made already. And here he is, just after Easter, declaring himself essentially the second coming of Christ. Have you ever seen anything quite this insane? And where does he go from here? Because everything he said about Joe Biden, it's kind of like he's done that, but far, far worse.
That's really absolutely lunatic. That's narcissistic on an overdose of steroids, what we see here. It's delusional Trump. It's deep Trump. He's drowning in this deep state quagmire he promised to dry out. And I'm really disappointed. I've criticized in this first term his foreign policies, but praised his most domestic policies. And when he won the election, when his comeback, so to say, I was happy more because of the loss of the Democrats than of his victory. But in the beginning of his second term, the first weeks or the first 100 days or so, I really was enthusiastic because it was an astonishing dynamic in this administration. And the spending cuts by done by Doge, for example, and a lot of executive orders. But despite his majority in the House of Representatives and the Senate and the Congress, nothing was put into law. Every executive direction, every of this presidential executive orders can be revoked by the next president. It's nothing at all sustainable. And then came that point when it felt every second minute, every 2 minutes, Bibi Netanyahu was knocking on the door of the White House, and the grace started, and it's really it's deep Trump, it's delusional Trump, self-proclaimed supreme leader of the United States is a pathological case in my eyes. Not political, that's pathological. He needs a doctor, and he risks a World War III, and he is fully the vessel, the stooge of Israel, of a crazy lunatic genocidal Israeli regime. And we can only hope that that fragile situation we now have will not escalate until the midterm elections, and that of course I think then there will be a comeback of the Democrats with all these AOC lunatics and this woke craze, but at least we can hope that there will be successfully an impeachment which spares the world a third huge devastating war, because it's really very dangerous what we see here, and the economic problems we will experience, even if they would end this war tomorrow, we will definitely see all over the world the long term effects of that craze.
See, the interesting thing with Trump is he came in with everything. He won the Senate, he won the House, so he was in complete control of Congress, and he obviously won the presidency. So the three sort of the three bodies of power in America, federally, he was in control of them. He had this mandate that I'm not sure when anyone else had that much of a mandate to control both the House and the Senate and to have the presidency is incredible. And really, to make big changes, you do need all three, because if you have one of the three, the other two can gang up on you, and you end up in this sort of political stalemate where everything you do, you know, with the right hand, the left hand does the opposite. And that prevents you from making change. But he had this unbelievable chance to deliver on a series of promises, to deliver on the end to foreign wars, to deliver on deportations, to deliver on the economy, to deliver on an end to mass immigration, to make life better for normal people with Medicare, Medicaid and daycare promises, part of this big, beautiful budget he talked about. I mean, nakedly, he has now stated that there won't be Medicare, Medicaid and daycare. He can't afford to pay for those. He said, we can't do that when we're fighting wars. You know, and all of his predecessors were at least intelligent enough not to be that stupidly brazen. You know, I'm not saying that the people who came before Trump were better people, but they at least had the intelligence that when they were urinating in your drinking water, they wouldn't be standing there laughing at you as they were doing it, saying, look, I'm urinating in your drinking water. You know, they'd urinate on you, but tell you it was raining. Trump, he doesn't even try to hide it. He doesn't try to hide what he's doing. And he seems so divorced from reality. I can only see this leading to midterm elections that hand everything to the Democrats and potentially lead to his impeachment. But again, in America, the entire anti-immigration populist movement, the MAGA movement, is tied totally to Donald Trump. So Donald Trump bringing down the economy, Donald Trump breaking all the promises. Now, this won't necessarily cause everyone to go out and vote for the Democrats. And I'm not stupid enough to believe it. Well, I've been in politics long enough to know how people think and how they vote. There'll be plenty of people out there who voted for Trump that won't switch to the Democrats, but they will stay at home and refuse to go out and vote Republican again in protest, essentially gifting it to the Democrats. You know, we saw this in the UK at the last general election where Keir Starmer got fewer votes than Jeremy Corbyn, but Jeremy Corbyn was called a failure and Keir Starmer had a record majority in Parliament. Why was that? Well, when fewer people are voting for him, how could he have possibly done that? Well, Conservative voters, some of them went out and voted Conservative, a small amount went out and started voting Reform, but the majority just stayed at home, gifting it to the Labour Party. And I think that is what we are going to see very soon in America. I think very soon in America, we're going to see the same thing. But unfortunately, and I know a lot of nationalists will be saying, well, this is good. Trump's going to be out. But I can only see this leading to a return of the woke politics, the anti-white politics, the policy making that caused the MAGA movement to come to power in the first place. The very things that we all despised and gritted our teeth over, they're going to come back as a result of Trump's incompetence. Is there any hope for white America now, Sasha? Or is this nailed on? They're going to be a minority. Trump screwed it. The deportation farce with ICE, the wars, the economic, the dire economic situation in America, the complete betrayal of the working white American by Trump. Is this the final nail in the coffin? I mean, we're looking at 2040 for a minority there. Now that Trump's blown it, is there any turning it around? Or is this going to be a situation from here on in of, well, can we save this particular state? You know, California's gone, Texas has gone, but can we save, I don't know, you know, can we save Arkansas?
Arkansas, Idaho, yeah. It's a very interesting and also a very important question. And I think here we have a president with maybe, depending on his age, has a psychological problem. Moreover, he is in Mar-a-Lago, surrounded by people behaving like in a sect, all sycophants, and making politics with incompetent secretaries like, just have a look to Drunken Hexet, an outspoken expert in strategic stupidity like this. And that will be a really that only can fail. And then we have another, maybe the ones of the viewers who are interested in history, or maybe some older one of the the audience today will remember back 1956 when in Egypt when this Suez crisis had been, and it also resulted in an energy crisis, and it was a huge setback for Britain as a world power, not least because that crisis resulted in a change of the monetary relevance of the pound sterling. And I make a bit of an analogy. What back then had been the Suez crisis is now the Hormuz crisis. And maybe soon, due to the Yemen allies of Iran, the Bab el-Mandeb crisis. And the transfer of the ships is aligned to tolls. And we see a change. If you look, it is around about $1 trillion a year, per year, for the oil trade, in this hydrocarbon dollar complex. But more and more, and that will accelerate through this, Suez crisis 2.0, which is the Hormuz crisis now, that will shift the monetary system, more and more of those energy trades are made in regional currencies, and more are made in the Chinese currency, in the yuan. And I think we will see also a paradigm shift in the monetary system as a result of that situation, and that will have an impact if the United States will be a world power as it is, a unipolar world power, global power, in the future. And unfortunately, there is a political system, the two parties. But if it's the Republicans or the Democrats, the problem is that I assume 99%. Of the congressmen and congresswomen are, doesn't matter what label, if Democrat or Republican, are on the payroll of AIPAC. And but there's one aspect that could be interesting, and not in the highly mass immigration, foreign infiltrated melting pot areas, but in the several in the states with the Rust Belt, blue collar rural areas, we named Idaho, maybe is one of that. After a change back to the Democrats, the U.S. politics are more and more centralizing And due to that centralizing, and they will have to do that if they want to implement the woke agenda. And that's not typical for the spirit, how that nation was built due to its constitution. And the only chance for white people in America would be due to this a kind of a secession 2.0. Back then, 1861, the secession was not about the question of slavery. That's propaganda, historic propaganda bullshit. It was because of the political centralized heteronomy affecting the federal states. And maybe if the United States will become more and more patronizing, maybe there will be we will see some first deliberations in some federal states in that regard, because why staying with the United States in the post-unipolar world? I don't know. It's all, we lack the crystal ball. It's all ideas or maybe a recommendation to the last, more or less, vast homogeneous federal states in the USA, to think about it, that, the completely different future I've spoken before, that will maybe, recommends to separate from that sinking Titanic in Washington, and I would be glad to hear that the Pentagon is the Pentagon.
I like that. That's good. I might steal that in future, but I will always credit you. Look, I fundamentally agree, and we've got one. We have got one last topic, and the last topic for discussion today before we go to the super chats. I've not got a huge amount of super chats tonight. If you want to super chat, if you want to support me, please do consider sending a super chat. You can do so via Entropy or via Rumble, and we'll read them all out and answer them in full in the second half of the show. But I've been a big critic of the Ukrainian conflict, and I've been a massive critic of Zelensky. And since day one, I've always said that Ukrainian nationalists, rather than signing up and fighting for Zelensky, should have broken away, taken their weapons, their guns, their tanks, and declared an independent state in eastern Ukraine for themselves, but refused to fight the Russians, maybe not fought Zelensky in their own government, but declared independence and used this time of instability to basically make something for themselves. And, you know, if they were brave enough, turn the tanks around and, you know, go for Kiev, because Zelensky's a madman. He is a dictator. And I always said he wasn't going to do good things for the nationalists fighting for his cause, for the American State Department, for the EU. And people say, well, oh, but Zelensky's letting all these nationalists fight for him. Well, of course he is. He's using them as cannon fodder. Zelensky has armed nationalists in Ukraine and entice nationalists to go and fight in Ukraine, using them as cannon fodder against the Russians. But I posited at the end of this war, what you'll see is a massive replacement of white Ukrainians, a huge amount of immigration. And I also said that any nationalists that do survive this conflict will not have a homeland. They'll have no place to go. And I said that Zelensky was changing the constitution and the laws in Ukraine to make it less hospitable to those nationalists who were fighting for him. And a few years ago, I made a big noise about the anti-LGBT hate speech laws that came into force. I also made a big noise about Zelensky closing down Russian Orthodox churches and essentially throwing churchgoers out in the street. And there were images of that that happened. And I made a big deal about the conscription of increasingly younger white men who were then sent off to die fighting the Russians. All of those things disgusted me. But in the last week, it's become evident that things have got even worse. Zelensky has just brought in special laws to combat anti-Semitism in Ukraine, which will lead to up to 8 years imprisonment for those who break these new laws. So all of these groups, like Azov, Misanthropic Division, all these people that have gone over there and fought for the Ukraine under symbols that would be banned in Sasha's fatherland, those people will have no place in the Ukraine when this war concludes. And a while back, I did a long-form video about a guy called Denis Kapustin, who went by the name White Rex. And at the end of that video, I issued sort of a chilling warning to those fighting for Zelensky. And I said this: if you're a nationalist and you're fighting for Zelensky in the Ukraine, one of two things is going to happen. The first is you will die for a Jewish dictator. The second is, if you don't die, you will have no place in the world when this war concludes. You won't be welcome in Russia because you fought the Russians. You won't be welcome in Ukraine because Zelensky will pass legislation to make everything you thought you were fighting for illegal. And you won't be welcome in Western Europe or America, because Western Europe and America were about to declare Azov and other Ukrainian militias as terrorist groups before the outbreak of this war. The only reason that was shelved is because those militias were used as cannon fodder and were fighting the Russians and were some of the most enthusiastic adopters of the war, most willing to march off and fight that battle. This is a disaster. Why are any nationalists still supporting this conflict? I don't know. But any that are, you will not have a homeland in Ukraine now because of what Zelensky has done. He is a dictator. He is anti-white. He is pro-immigration, pro-LGBT. He is anti-free speech. If he wins in Ukraine, every part of that country that he controls will be everything that a white nationalist should be appalled by. Yet they're still fighting for him. And sometimes I think to myself, how are people fooled by this? Why would anyone fight for Zog? Because that's what this is. If you're fighting for NATO, if you're fighting for the EU, if you're fighting for the American State Department, if you're fighting for Zelensky, you're not fighting for white people. You're fighting, you're being used as a proxy, as a mercenary for an anti-white globalist cabal. And this proves it more than anything. But I feel like I'm smashing my head against a wall with some people because they're going to keep pushing this. They're going to say, well, because these guys are flying a certain flag from what's left of their tanks, they're the good guys. They're going to win a nationalist future. They're not. Any that return home after this war will be silent and potentially imprisoned under these new laws. Sasha, I know you've been a vocal critic of this war, just as I have. These new laws that Zelensky's passing, they are directly going to infringe on the nationalists that have been fighting for it. How can people square this circle?
I think a very, very important aspect in this context to see is one should not make the mistake of believing that the Greater Israel project can be reduced solely to the Middle East or understood purely in territorial terms. The Greater Israel project is a Jewish supremacist project. So it reaches much farther than only the Middle East, because it's about influence. More than influence, influential dominance. And maybe now that the Israeli government, and unfortunately backed by large sections, by large majority of the Israeli population, not all, not everyone, but a large majority of the Israeli population backs that, unfortunately and unbelievably. And as the Israel behaves like the rabbit dog, like other ethnicities genociding, behaves like a mad, maybe one could say, ethno-serial killer, maybe they have the plan B in case if that backfires. So to say that God decides to discard them rather than choose them, they have the plan B. And one of these plan Bs is the dispopulated Ukraine. And maybe another part of this plan B is the entirely coincidental fires in Patagonia in Latin America. which facilitate easy and cheap land purchases. So what I want to say is that Greater Israel, as the peace policy of Netanyahu, is a piece of Jordan, a piece of Syria, a piece of Lebanon, and that's his peace policy. But that Greater Israel reduced to the Middle East is not enough for those Jewish supremacists. And that goes beyond simply influential dominance by lobbyism. It's also in territorial terms. I think they prepare colonies. They prepare colonies for Jews in the future. And but the current situation in the current situation there was never since decades or even longer, maybe since protests since centuries, there was not the Zionists, the Jewish supremacists, have not been criticized as they face it today. And they fight back this by that complete irrationality of this alleged anti-Semitism. Being against the Gaza genocide is anti-Semitic. I have read recently, I've read in I think it was in the Times of Israel, an op-ed with a headline, being against abortion is anti-Semitic. And if for example, a queer lunatic mentions Jews as inventors of gender grays and multiple genders, it's then, if a queer lunatic does that, it's a progressive praise. However, if Mark Collett does that, it's anti-Semitic. That's a huge irrationality. And usually within state legal systems, the standard criminal offenses relating to defamation are usually codified and can be invoked indiscriminately by those affected. But however, the how should I describe it? The politicized theater surrounding anti-Semitism constitutes a kind of a special legislation, and that's the problem, a special legislation that opens the floodgates to arbitrariness by subsuming any criticism, however remote, under the label of anti-Semitism. And even if completely independent, even if you mention relevant facts and evidence, it's subsumed under anti-Semitism, thereby instrumentalizing a undefined term legally, silences that criticism. And it has to be noted that that so-called anti-Semitism didn't arise in a vacuum, and it's not caused, not in the slightest, I dare to say, by those who are labeled as anti-Semites. It essentially it's caused by Israel itself and by the Jewish lobby, such as the before-mentioned AIPAC. And it speaks volumes when the exercise of freedom of expression in criticizing the actions, activities of the Israeli government and the Jewish lobby is met with far harsher penalties than, for example, sexually abusing minors. That's alarming. And in particular, that criticism, which is currently most justified, and even in the name of humanitarianism, most urgently needed, that particular criticism is made punishable by the label anti-Semitism. And we have to reach the point where it simply remains to be seen how much of a desire for freedom we Goyims ultimately possess. Ultimately, the only question is whether we will be silenced behind bars or muzzled in an open-air prison by complying, But we should never forget, and that's a very important reminder, freedom of expression survives only by making use of it. That's what I'm convinced.
Thank you. That's a very good place to bring the first half of the show to a close. We're going to do the super chats now. If you haven't super chatted and you want to support the show, if you want to support me, please do consider giving a donation. We're going to go through the ones that we have received tonight. So thank you to those who have donated. The first is $20 from Tomorrow's Victims. And he said, "Hey, Mark, what is your opinion on the coming midterm election in the States? What results would you think would offer the best opportunities? Or does it even matter at all, as it seems like we are ruled by a single system that shifts either way to obtain its objectives? Big fan of your positivity. Cheers." Well, I think firstly, let's talk about what the outcome is going to be. I think both myself and Sasha would be united in saying, at this current time, unless something happens which is truly seismic, which I doubt it's going to, I think the whole of Congress is going to be Democrat majority. So both the Senate and the House, you know, will go to the Democrats. And I think that will leave Trump in a position where impeachment is likely. I think they will go for impeachment. I think his behavior, his illegal war, I think some of the things that he's been doing in terms of the economics that have basically taken people to the point of being on the breadline, they will go for him and they will have a lot of support in doing so. When you say what is the perfect outcome, well, the perfect outcome is we wake up tomorrow.
Homeless Messi for president.
the perfect outcome is we wake up tomorrow and I am given superpowers, like some kind of, I wake up and I have the ability to go Super Saiyan. I fly up into the atmosphere, land in America, get Trump by the throat and impose my will brutally upon America and restore it within 5 years to a white European majority. That's the best case scenario, but it's not going to happen. So what is the best case scenario in terms of what can likely happen? And you said I'm very positive, but I don't really have anything positive to say. I actually don't see a best case scenario in America, because we've got really three factions. We have the Democrats. That is not a good case scenario. If they get back in, you've got a return to pro-immigration. You've got a return to anti-white, woke, liberal politics, reparations, diversity quotas, all of those things will be back on the table. And as we've seen with Zohran Mamdani in New York, they're no longer talking about equality. They're talking about what they call equity. And equity means, you know, in a very, very stripped down manner, taking the wealth of white people and giving it to non-white people. That's what they mean when they talk about equity. They're no longer saying we want equality of opportunity. They're saying that we're going to force equality of outcome by taking money, houses, generational wealth off white people and giving it to non-white people. That's where you're going. So the Democrats are a non-starter. Any nationalists that tell you that's going to be a good thing, it's not. The second faction is your traditional rhino neocon Republicans. They are the people that the Republican Party was meant to be wrestled away from. A return to them would be seen now by many, sadly, as a positive. You know, talking about a return to the times of George W. Bush or Ronald Reagan, many Americans would happily say, let's go back to the Reagan era. The Reagan era, that was the good times. Let's get in the time machine. Let's jump in the DeLorean. We're going back to the 80s or early 90s. Many Americans would see that now as probably best case scenario. Standards of living were good. Costs of living were low. There was just the right amount of technology. White America was still on top. It was the boom before the collapse. So sadly, that looks like it's on the table. But from our point of view in the current economic and racial climate, a return to rhino neocon America is not good, because they're not going to help the white people. They're not going to make things better. Their number one goal will be enriching themselves and helping Israel and potentially starting more foreign wars. Because if there's one thing that neocons love, it's a foreign war. Going back to them is not a good thing. But finally, the third faction was this MAGA movement, was this movement to wrestle the Republican Party away from the neocons and the rhinos and take it in a new direction, take it back to being a party that was there for your non-Hispanic white, as they're called in the census, non-Hispanic white American, you know, hard-working family that were the backbone of America. And that has been truly subverted. So now, any one of those three factions, and they are the three factions that can win, the Democrats are the most likely to win, but any one of those three factions can win, and, you know, a combination of the neocons and the MAGAtards are now in power, but any one of those is a disaster for white people. Because what is MAGA going to bring you now? Well, it's going to bring you more immigration. It's going to make deportations look like something normal people won't go along with. It's more wars, which is the same as the neocons, but it's all being done under what appears to be this insane dementia-ridden emperor who believes he's a cross between Julius Caesar, Joseph Stalin and Jesus. That's what he thinks he is. You know, on one hand, he's issuing decrees that you bend over or he's going to crush you. The next day, you know, he's talking as like he's this great conquering hero. And the next day, he's literally posting memes that he is the reincarnation of Jesus Christ. Could this be any worse? And I want there to be positivity. But I'm going to give you the only positive outcome. And I said this when I had that debate and argument with Adam Green. The only positive outcome now is that federal America collapses, that the entire federal system collapses, that the states secede, that we go back to the being 50 separate countries rather than a United States. Each state takes its destiny into its own hands. The multiracial states like California collapse under the weight of their own failure. And the white states that still farm, that still mine resources, and that still have some semblance of white community, they go on. And groups like potentially the Mormons or the Amish continue to grow. There are white pockets of decent, moral, small-town Americans that come out of this stronger rather than weaker. But I can't see a way for white Americans to come out of what we're seeing now with any of those three factions in charge and life getting better. It is either federal collapse or it's white death. It's one or the other. The only way for whites to survive in America now, I believe, is for the whole system to collapse. If, and it's a huge if people don't see that, if we don't see that, and that is a big if, because for the federal government to collapse, that's a massive thing, but that's the only way out. I think we've seen now with Trump, if Trump has proved one thing, it's that voting some guy in and hoping for him to change the system from the inside is a non-starter.
Absolutely right.
Do you have anything to add to that, mate? I mean, go for it. I mean, I've just gone off on one for 5 minutes.
If the neocons would make a comeback, we had the USA would go back to the plutocratic oligarchy, and people would become in positions like, for example, John Bolton, who strives to start a war with everyone he can find within seconds.
Well, that's, yeah, there's very few ways out of this for the white man. But one thing that has been shown in America, with their strict two-party system and Democrat or Republican, it seems impossible. I mean, maybe there is a fourth faction, but the fourth faction would be even more grim. I think the fourth faction would be somebody like your Bernie Sanders taking over the Democrats and getting into power with a naked multiracial form of communism, at which point, well, you know, that could arguably worse than the other three factions. But that's a great super chat. I want to thank you. I know you sent that in the other day on the Nationalist A team, but we got sort of very distracted talking about vaccinations. We never got round to talking about that, but I hope we gave you the full sort of 15 minutes you deserve on that topic, because it was really, really good. Aunt Sally gave $5. Thank you so much, and said, say hi to Sasha for me. I met him at the conference and he dwarfed me. He is such a lovely gentleman. He certainly is. He's a hero of our people. Some guy 14 gave $5. Thank you so much. And he said, thoughts on Dostoevsky's quote, beauty will save the world. Ugh. Will beauty save the world? I don't know. I mean, I recommend
to bring forward that quote or that question again when we next month talk about my book, Culture, Aesthetics, Identity. Then it completely fits into the program then. But I personally think we are living in times where everything, where the ugliness, in the realm of ugliness, destroying the souls, and aesthetics. Or I think aesthetics are important because if we look back to the ancient times where the aesthetic was held high, it was back that times in the cradle of Europe, where at the Apollon temple was written Gnothisiauton, recognize yourself. And I think probably beauty, if it can save the world, I don't know, but at least it doesn't, it for sure it doesn't make it more problematic.
I'll say this. I think beauty is an inspiration. I think when you see something that is beautiful, whether it be architecture, art, or the Western woman, I think those things are worth fighting for, they're worth shedding blood for, and they're worth bleeding for. And I think the latter point is more important than the former. Being willing to shed blood for something is one thing. Being willing to bleed for something you love is another. I think we're all willing to shed blood for something, but are we willing to bleed for what we love? I think that's really the question. If you truly love something, you are willing to bleed for it. You know, if you just have desire for something, yeah, anyone can go out there and shed someone else's blood for what they desire, but would they be willing to bleed themselves dry for the thing they love? And for beauty, you will often do that. For the beauty of Western civilization, I think people would be willing to do that. I think that's something that is inspirational. But I have a much darker take on this. I think whilst beauty inspires us, what will save us is struggle. Our people have been insulated in gilded cages. They don't know struggle and strife anymore. They've become soft and flabby and reliant on a system, reliant on benefit payments, reliant on the central heating always working. They are so disconnected from the natural world and the struggle and strife that made us the warriors that we were. It's victory that has defeated us. We have been on top for so long, and that comfort that comes from being on top has insulated us from the natural world. And it is the natural world and the struggle within the natural world that makes you strong. It makes you hardy. It keeps you sharp. You know, to draw an analogy, if you're a boxer and you're constantly facing top tier opponents and you know your next opponent's going to be a top tier opponent, you train, you're hard, it's the struggle, it keeps you on the edge. If as a boxer you're carried and you're given weak opponents and you don't fight very often, you actually don't stay on top, really. And when you do face a strong opponent, you go down very quickly and it's a horrible shock. And I think that's where we are. We have been insulated. And I've talked about the gilded cage many times. I've talked about Francis Parker Yockey's enemy of Europe. I spoke about it the other night when we were talking about NATO. I did a great review of it with Greg Johnson, Natty and Aunt Sally. And I've said that the problem is we have been softened up. We've been fattened up for the kill. We've had it too easy. And if we are to be the warrior people, the hardy people that built Europe, we need to become tough again. And beauty may inspire us for great deeds, but if we are to commit to great deeds, we must be strong enough mentally, physically, and spiritually to weather this coming storm. That's really my take on it. Pretty grim.
A few words. So that is, if some, I think there is one aspect where beauty is, beauty can be a kind of a remedy, maybe. Because if some contemporary art, for example, triggers stress hormones, it's because the prevailing art is not only a mirror image, but also often a magnifying glass of the collective psychological state or the manipulative influences of its time. And I love one quote from Wolfgang von Goethe in his famous novel, Wilhelm Meister. He lets one of his, of the figures in his novel, he lets say, and I love that quote, "Every day one should hear at least one little song, read a good poem, see an excellent painting, and if possible, say a few sensible words." And I think in that sense understood, beauty can be a remedy against the contaminations of an ugly time.
Well, thank you very much for that. Dechuruska gave $5. Thank you so much. Said, powerful show and powerful takes. Das Leben ist Kampf. Thank you very much. Full Kamerad gave $3. Thank you so much. Said, I'm looking forward to the reopening of... I'm not sure if I can even say that. Because of Sasha being on the show. So thank you so much for the super chat. But I don't want to say anything that might be illegal in Germany and that could get my good friend arrested. So
then let's spin a dance around, and I can assure you, have a good fantasy.
Yes. Skins 88 gave $10. Thank you so much, and said, hello again, Mark. I just want to say that it's okay you're against alcohol, mate, but I can't see a way that our British lads make it out while this putting down our skinhead brothers, mate. It's the only way for us to survive, mate. We've got to show the world that we are strong fighters. Look. The battle that we have coming, we're going to need to be mentally sharp, physically sharp, and spiritually strong. If you like a drink in your own free time, recreationally, that's up to you. I choose not to. But politically, we need to divorce ourselves from anything that brings us down and makes us less than our best. We need to be clean. We need to be sharp. We need to be the best versions of ourselves we can. I appreciate your sacrifice and your super chats, but respectfully, I've turned my back on alcohol. Not because I'm a stick in the mud, not because I can't have fun, but because I want to be a clean, strong, good version of myself. And the money that I used to spend on beer, I spend on a gym membership. And I can tell you this now, I have never woken up in the morning and felt better for drinking too much beer. But I have woken up in the morning and felt better for being at the gym the previous day. That's a positive Mark Collett take for you. Embrace self-improvement. Spend your money on making yourself into the best version of yourself that you possibly can. I don't know if you've got any takes on that, Sasha.
Yes, as a Bavarian, obviously, I I enjoy the Bavarian beer, and from time to time I like to drink with my my comrades. But discipline is everything, and a sign of being strong is being capable of enjoy everything, but don't be depend on anything. Don't enjoy everything, need nothing.
That is a brilliant quote. Enjoy everything, need nothing. Yeah, I agree. St. Harrison gave $3. Thank you so much. Said, always good to see Sasha. I'll be getting a copy of his book based on the cover alone. If he holds the book up again, you'll see two more reasons to buy in addition to the content. Thank you so much. Scaredy Cat gave $8. Thank you very much. And said, hi, Sasha and Mark. We must think hard. What's deep bone structure of reality? Just saying, President Trump's crazy is kind of lying. Britain's was the first ruling state that is the unstoppable winner, which got substituted by the USA in World War II. Now it is the Jewish community. Stay good. Well, she's very right. The British Empire was the first, and that was largely ruled by powerful Jewish bankers. They supplanted that with America, and now they are finally running America into the ground, and the next ruling state will likely nakedly be Israel. A very, very prescient super chat there. And thank you so much for your kind and continued support. It means a great, great deal to me. I don't know if you want to comment on that, Sasha, or even if you can comment on that.
I agree. And history gave evidence of that. And we already mentioned the AIPAC influence, and it's no secret anymore who runs the plutocratic oligarchy.
Thank you. Poit gave $25. Thank you so much, and said donation. Hazelnut 3000 gave $10 and said donation. Well, thank you very much. It was made up, gifted 5 subscriptions. Thank you very much. And that is very generous. And I say this all the time. Look, you can subscribe to me at any time you want on Rumble. If we had, you know, 400 or 500 subscribers on Rumble every month, that would really, really help me out. And people accept these subscriptions, but then don't maintain them. If you get a free sub, please just maintain them. It would make a great difference to me. You know, everyone's feeling the bite here. I understand not everyone can donate, but you know, if people want me to keep doing this, I do need those donations. I'm not asking for millions of dollars. I'm not doing a Tommy Robinson. Can I have another £300,000 tomorrow so we can hold a big, you know, knees up in London? But you know, things like the subscriptions being maintained does make a difference. Iggs22 gave $5. Thank you so much. And he said, Mark, I saw a clip of He-Man on his knees, Skeletor frying him, and then he rose up to grab his sword and roared, I have the power. Memories came flooding back. Do you reckon small lads today see enough masculine energy? No, I don't. One thing that I'll note, when I was a little boy, the sort of heroes were very, very masculine men. As a child, I remember my favourite sort of toys being He-Man, Lego. I really liked Lego, but also the Transformers. And basically, when you were playing with He-Man, you know, you were playing with this toy of Aryan Uberman. When you were playing with Transformers, it was these big battling robots. And when you were building your Lego, for me it was always knights. I've still got the, I think it was 1984 1986, somewhere around there, boxed big original Lego castle somewhere in my loft. And I loved that. I loved, you know, that sort of masculinity. And children were surrounded by masculine heroes. Boys were surrounded by this masculinity, and their heroes were these sort of supermen or big warrior characters, these heroes. Now, what is it now? Harry Potter, some gimpy little wizard, you know, waving his wand. I don't know. But that masculinity has been taken away from young boys. And I don't think it's a coincidence that young boys today are more effeminate, more weak, more willowy. And I do think it's important that young boys have those masculine heroes, whether it be, you know, the cowboys of the old West, whether it be knights in shining armor, whether it be He-Man, big battling robots, you know, or even sort of, you know, in Japan, they have characters that are highly masculine, you know, that fight each other to the death. But all of those things have slowly been taken away all across the world. And it's, yeah, it's sad. It's sad. Sasha, what do you think about this? Young boys being brought up in a less masculine environment.
I think that's very, very problematic, this effemination of the young boys. Young boys need role models, need father figures, need some idols. And they, it's very, I think it's very, very important to start with sports at a very early age. That doesn't mean that someone who never had done sports, that it is too late. It's never too late. But what you train in the years when you're children and in your teenage years, you profit from it your whole life. I made this experience by myself. In the meanwhile, I'm older than 50 years. I'm becoming 54 years this year. And of course I don't make sports every day. And I had a little bit of my belly, a little bit of the obesity, but I still do my gardening and I still do sports. And I have done extremely much sports in my younger days. And then I was making athletics. I was playing football. I was doing martial arts. I was boxing Muay Thai. And when I was young, I trained every day. And even today, I admit I'm a little bit too fat and sometimes too lazy, but I'm still comparable to the people in my age. I'm fit enough to stand my man. And then, for example, 2 years ago, after I was at the PA conference, I made the push-up challenge and I made more than 10,000 in 1 year. Despite there was no over 50 category, I did it despite my weight. I did it with more than 10,000 in a month. And that's only possible because today I'm not training every day and I'm not training three or four times a week. I do a little bit, but I still profit from what I have done when I was young. And that's what I can recommend, and that's really, really important.
Yeah, and I think this is a really important point to make. Having a good community, and me and Sasha are two of the nationalists, along with people like Dan Erickson, Woodlander, the guys from Return to the Land, that are pushing white intentional communities. When you have a community, so if you're sat at home, I can tell you this. If you said to me, do 250 push-ups every day for yourself, that's hard. If you say to me, do 250 push-ups because Sasha's doing them, Natty's doing them, Sam's doing them, Euro's doing them, that's only a joke, Euro, you're never going to do them, are you, mate? But all the lads that I respect are doing them. You do them because you don't want to say to your friends and members of the community, I didn't do my push-ups today. I was doing the push-ups that year when I did 600 a day for the whole of November and I did 18,000 in November. I did that because I said to the lads, I'm going to smash it. And I didn't want to let them down. I didn't do it for me. I didn't do it because, you know, it was making my shoulders and elbows feel fantastic. By the end of it, I can remember the cartilage grinding on the bone. I did it because we were part of that community and I didn't want to let people down. So join our community, get involved in the fitness groups, do 9,000 in November with us this year, get fit with us, make yourself masculine. And if you've got a little boy like I have, you know, make sure you get him some of those He-Man toys and he'll grow up to be a tough, strong, masculine male that'll want to save his race. He'll want to raise his arm in the air and say, I have the power. And by the way, I already have. We've got a couple of toy swords, which interestingly, my daughter asked for Christmas one year. And my son loves nothing more than toddling around the living room, waving a sword above his head and shouting unintelligible nonsense. I mean, he's only 13 months, so he's not going to be, you know, reciting Shakespeare. But it is good to see. And if you give little boys masculine toys from young age, they it's like they instinctively know what to do with a sword. Trust me.
In my age, Mark, my shoulders didn't feel good when doing that, but I did it because I came home from the PA conference and told my wife that I had a big mouth. And after she also knew that I had a big mouth, I was frightened she loses respect if I didn't do it then. And I had to deliver.
That's the way you've got to be. Midnight Division became a monthly supporter. Thank you so much, my friend. That means a great deal. Remember, if you're watching this on replay, you can become a monthly sub at any time. It makes a massive difference to me. That regular income means I don't have the stress of hoping for super chats and wondering if people are going to donate. If people do that and just pledge a small amount every month, I've always said this, you know, tonight we've got 300 people or more live watching the show. If everyone just gave $3 or $5, they wouldn't miss it, but it would mean the world to me, and it would mean that I didn't have to worry about things. So thank you so much to Midnight Division, and a massive thank you to Baba 2, who gave an incredibly generous $50. Thank you so much, mate. You've been so generous. I can't thank you enough. If you're ever in the UK, like I say to any of the donors, you want to look me up or come for dinner, you're more than welcome to. He said, as an American, I share your views on the US government failing. What's best for my people? It's not luxury. It's going to have to be struggle, and I'm up for the fight. Well, I'm pleased you concur with what we're saying. You know, and look, struggle makes you feel good. And I'll tell you how struggle makes you feel good from a child's perspective. My daughter never wanted to eat carrots. She didn't like carrots. But we grew some carrots the other year in our garden. And last year, in fact. And for the record, they were the worst carrots ever. They were all tiny and slugs ate most of them. But you know what? When my daughter pulled up the carrots that she helped to grow and that she watered every day and that she looked after and tended to, she enjoyed them. And she said they were the best carrots ever. And that's because when you do something and you struggle and it's hard and you put effort into it, it feels better when you get to the finish line. When you get to the finish line, whatever you've put that effort into, you love it more, you cherish it more. Things you get for free, you don't love in the same way as things you worked for and things you toiled over. So I agree. Struggle is what makes us great. Struggle is the essence of the white man's spirit and soul. And every bit of art and beauty we create has come from struggle. And that's what makes that art and beauty more special. It makes it resonate with us on a deeper level. So I think really we're trying to sort of marry the beauty and the struggle as one, but I think there is a deep connection. Do you want to add anything to that, Sasha?
That example with the carrot and your daughter tells or teaches us that this was more than just nourishing, that was character building. Education of a white for a responsible father.
Yes. Well, I'm not sure if I'm truly responsible, but I'm certainly not completely irresponsible either. So I'm somewhere in between. One question. Here's the thing. My daughter's six. Is Lord of the Rings going to be too old and too scary for a six-year-old? What do people think in the chat? Yes or no to letting her watch Lord of the Rings? We'll see what people say. We've got some more super chats here. Fashy Zuma gave $5. Thank you so much. She said, hey, Mark, I just want to say that I've been taking my health more seriously as a nationalist. Thanks to you. And would like to know if you have any specific routine to stay on top of your health. I know if I'm not healthy, people will not take me seriously. Well, I can tell you this. There are several things that you can do on a small level to make yourself healthier. Now, one thing that I do, and this might sound silly, is I walk everywhere. If I can walk somewhere, I will walk. One of the problems that people have is if they go to the shop these days, even though it's only 5 minutes walk, they will take the car because they're lazy. I walk everywhere now. And I walk everywhere because as I get older, that extra bit of exercise helps me keep in shape. And I think people can make small changes to their life, walk, take the stairs instead of the lift, go to the gym 3 times a week, Monday, back and biceps, Wednesday, shoulders, Friday, chest and triceps. If you can't afford the gym, get some cheap dumbbells and a bench. If you have 2 pieces of equipment at home, make it a bench and dumbbells. With those, you can do your chest, your triceps, your shoulders, your biceps, and your back. If that's all you can afford, get an old bench off eBay, have somebody bring it to your house, and a few dumbbells. And with that, you can make a big difference. You know, if you can't afford the gym membership, do that. It's small things every day that makes the positive change when it comes to fitness. You don't need to be like, right, tomorrow I'm running a marathon. Tomorrow I'm going to go and lift everything at the gym and I'm going to be a power lifter. It's those little changes, making, you know, the time to have a little walk, making the time to go to the gym when you can. Or if you can't, just doing a few weights every other day at home. Those little things all add up. And I remember when I first got involved in the BMP, I didn't have a car and I went leafleting all the time. And I'd fly around, you know, up and down streets, up and down driveways. I was so fast because I walked everywhere. But today, again, people have become so insulated that they'll hop in the car because it looks like it might rain and the shop's, you know, more than 10 minutes away. Don't do that. It makes a big difference. Do you have any small tips, Sasha, for keeping healthy?
Gardening. I love gardening. I make my own medicine with herbs, and I collect them in the wood. And I have a huge garden, and I grow my own seed. And that's partly if you're working with the soil in spring. That's like sport. But I would come back to your Tolkien and Lord of the Rings in 6 years. My son started watching Lord of the Ring. I think he was 7 or 8 years, not older. We allowed him to watch Lord of the Rings, not the today's Vogue version, the old version. And there have been a few scenes where he come a little bit closer to mama and papa, because a bit frightened, but it was fascinating for him. And he was playing in the garden, all this fighting, so he could develop a toxic masculinity. And today he's 25, my son. He has read everything from Tolkien, Hobbit, Lord of the Ring, the Silmarillion, and he read all the books then afterwards, more than just once.
Well, that's incredible. I mean, I am definitely, people in the chat have unanimously said, show a Lord of the Rings. It's quite interesting though, because like, when you're choosing what you want your kids to watch, like, you don't want them to be scared, but you don't want them to be wimps either, you know? So, and there is that fine line. So she's not going to be watching Nightmare on Elm Street or Saw or anything, you know, just yet. Yeah. But I think Lord of the Rings, we can go for that. Not that anyone should watch Saw. Saw is an awful, awful set of films. They're awful. Fashy Zuma gave another $3. Thank you so much. She said, also, would you prefer if people subscribe, or is Entropy okay? I see an option for it. Any form of donation is appreciated, however you make the donation, my friend. Whatever's easiest for you, whatever people want to do, whatever sits well with them. It's just, you know, as I say, this is sort of my only form of income. I don't have a bank account. I don't have another job. It's all quite hard and stressful. So, you know, if people do donate, it makes a great difference. And honestly, like those who do donate, I can't thank them enough. And as I've always said, if people are donors and, you know, they have supported me over the years, my door is always open to anyone who has helped me and my family. And I do mean that. I'm not a Tommy Robinson. I'm not somebody who's distant. I'm not somebody who's hard to get in touch with. And those who do help me, you know, as I say, you've got my email address. I'm always there to help you in any way I can. So thank you to those who've donated. Delta Troiske 125 gave $5. Thank you so much. Said, come on, people, support Mark. It's the same people every week. Look, I understand that things are hard for people. And obviously, I like it when people donate. But I hate to sort of put the heavy hand out there. And some people have been very generous tonight. And I know it's the same people. And I really do really, really appreciate it if people have donated. But that does, unfortunately. Oh, no, we've got one more donation. Thank you so much. He said, yo, mate, have your, from Agartha Man, who gave $3. He said, yo, mate, have your kids watched Harry Potter? It's about magic, which is, of course, an Aryan tradition. The Jew fears the magic Aryan. They haven't watched Harry Potter, actually. They haven't watched Harry Potter at all. Do you know what? My daughter, this is really interesting. When she first started watching TV, she used to love the original He-Man episodes, and she wanted to be Teela, and she used to run around pretending to sort of take people on, and that's who she wanted to be. And then she watched She-Ra, and she wanted to be sort of a warrior princess. So those were the things that sort of she really liked. But at the moment, she's reading a series of books about these fairies, and the fairies, they fight an evil king called Jack Frost, who has an army of goblins that do his bidding. So there is some sort of like heroism there. But one thing I've noticed about modern kids' TV is not only are there an awful lot of non-white characters just sort of everywhere, but now on every show, there's at least one character who's sort of in a wheelchair or missing a limb. In terms of inclusivity, and this sort of like, I don't like this either. She asked me, said, Daddy, why is this person not got a hand? And I actually Googled it, and it was like, well, this character doesn't have a hand because they want children to feel, I don't know, sorry, or that they should have a friend without a limb. And it's like, well, this is nonsense because these characters are magical fairies. Like, if you're living in a world where fairies can will whatever they want, surely a fairy would be able to will their hand back. I don't know. Like, if I lived in a magical wonderland where wishes came true, you know, none of my friends would be missing their, like, left hand. It's ridiculous. Have you noticed this?
I have an anecdote because we said missing the hand. when our son, when he was young, I wrote I didn't publish, maybe I should one day publish it. I wrote a children's version of the Germanic Nordic mythology and the Edda, because in the schools, the Bibles, there are children versions. And I wrote for my son, and before he could read himself, we read it to him, such a version. And one day he was five, six years young. He was jumping through the garden, and on the one hand, a wooden sword, and then the other hand, my wife and me, what's he doing? He had an empty cup put over his hand, and I said, what's that nonsense with that cup on the hand? And he, Daddy, don't you know I'm Tyr, and Fenris has bitten off my hand.
Well, I suppose that is the one sort of one positive you might take out of that. But as I say, this sort of thing now, though, it's so prevalent, and it's kind of like they sort of make the character sort of more special if there's sort of something that. So originally, sort of a character like He-Man was more special because he was perfect. Now the most special characters are the ones with like the most disabilities. I don't like really any of that. I don't really like the message it sends. And obviously there is something, though, heroic about a battle-hardened veteran who has lost a hand or an eye or has some kind of disfigurement. One thing that always used to amaze me as a child was Germans were always portrayed as the bad guy. And one of the sort of cliches of a German villain was what they always had a scar on their face. And later in life, when I reviewed the book, it might be here at my side. I've got like a bookshelf here, mainly computer games, but a tiny bookshelf here. but I do have a book somewhere. It's not actually, I don't think, it must be on my other bookshelf, called The Myth of German Villainy. And it's an excellent book that we reviewed on our channel. And The Myth of German Villainy is a very, very interesting book because it actually goes through some of these cliches. And one of the cliches about Germans having scars on their faces is actually true. They did. But it wasn't because they were villains. It was because they had a heroic and very masculine way of settling differences, which was to fence with each other, to basically...
They do it today. The students, some right-wing student communities, they still do it today. And they immediately, if they are injured, they saw it together without any painkillers and everything else. That's heroic, yeah.
Exactly. So these Germans with a scar on their face, they didn't have a scar on their face because they'd been doing something terrible and had been cut, you know, when committing some criminal act. They had scars on their faces because when they had a difference, they settled it like men with a duel. This was...
My lawyer, for example, has a few of that scars. He settled it also by fencing.
Yeah. It's incredible. You know, and I do also find that there is a nobility in settling a issue through martial prowess. And then at the end, shaking hands and saying, look, the issue is settled. We've had our fight. We've done what we needed to do. You know, we draw a line under it and we move on. That is a mark of a civilized society. A mark of an uncivilized society is holding on to, you know, these sort of bitter, petty grievances for the rest of your life. You know, if you have a falling out with a friend, it is better that you settle it. And I remember that as a sort of a child. You know, we would often fall out with a friend and you'd go out to some bushes or a little bit of land. You'd fight it out. After that, you'd shake hands and you'd be mates again. That would happen regularly. We've got one more super chat from Agartha Man. Thank you so much. He gave $5. And he said, speaking of the film Saw, what do you believe the effect of this is on younger generations? Movies like Saw are pushed a lot on young people and feel like they're meant to desensitize us to what the Jews are doing to our nations with migrants. I hate Saw. And the reason I hate it is for two reasons. Firstly, I'm a massive film fan and a superb horror film. Like the original Friday the 13th, like the original Halloween, the original Nightmare on Elm Street, or even modern classics like The Ring, do not show gore and a monster. They build up to a reveal, and the fear and the craftsmanship of creating fear is built via tension. So when you watch a film like Halloween, Michael Myers' presence doesn't make you scared because he's running around stabbing people. It makes you scared because it takes you a while to reveal it. This was actually the genius of Jaws. Now, Steven Spielberg actually wasn't a genius when he made Jaws. It was a failure that led to the film being a success. So originally, the shark was meant to be on the screen like all the time. But the shark model was terrible. It kept breaking and sinking. So they went for a style of filmmaking where instead of showing the shark, you got small glimpses of what you thought was the shark. And it was that that caused the tension and the fear. So it was actually a failure that led to a different approach to making the film that made it a success. Modern day horror films like Saw that put everything on the film, everything in front of you, the gore, the horror right in your face. That's not good filmmaking. That's lazy filmmaking. But it desensitizes you to gore and horror and leads to a ratcheting up of the stakes. So if you watch a man have his arm ripped off in the first film, in the next film, you want to see a guy get cut in half, or you want to see a guy, you know, get put into a meat grinder or set on fire. And each film ups the ante. And at that point, you're not watching a film for plot or tension or genuine fear. You're watching a film because you've fallen into this kind of world of torture porn where you're just seeing how far the envelope can be pushed, which desensitizes you to violence and gore. And being desensitized to violence and gore is what makes people think going out and getting involved in a war zone in somewhere like Ukraine is actually a good thing. They sit there watching violence and gore. They then graduate to places like 4chan, where they watch people getting blown up by drones. And to them, human life becomes disposable fun. And they actually develop some weird bloodlust for going and doing it themselves. It's why people today can watch this horrible gore and people dying in real life, and why you know, mainstream publications like the Daily Mail can show people being blown to pieces by grenades dropped from a drone. People just shrug their shoulders. Well, that guy getting blown up, it wasn't as bad as what happened in Saw 3, was it? I mean, that was really awful. You know, Jewish Hollywood has desensitized us to violence that would be unthinkable even in previous theatres of war. It is shocking. I don't know if you have any final takes on that, Sasha, but then we'll close things down.
I don't rarely watch horror shows. A few parliamentary sessions, maybe, but I'm not watching. So I'm not an expert on that issue.
Okay, well, thank you so much. Look, it's been a great show tonight. I want to thank Sasha. Sasha, give yourself a little outro. Tell us one last time where we can find your work and your book. And I want to thank you for being here. You've been amazing as always. I can't wait to read your book and review it next month.
You can reach me on Telegram. There is, under my name, there is a German language channel. But if you watch under Rossmüller Dissident, you find the English language channel. You can find me on X, where I'm writing bilingual German and English, very often English. You can find me on Getter. You can find me on Gap, where it's exclusively English on Gap. And I'm also on Substack, some articles in Substack to find. And I'm always glad being here, because it's always very, very interesting, deep delving discussions and good questions. And I'm very grateful having the opportunity, and I'm very grateful getting the opportunity promoting my book on this platform. And I'm looking forward to the show in, you said it will be in May, I think, next month, to talk a little bit in more detail about my book, Culture, Aesthetics and Identity.
Well, thank you very much. Four Camarade gave one last super chat for $3. Thank you so much, my friend. It really is appreciated that you donate so often. And he said, loving the Schaffers S and umlaut in your name, brother. Gott mit uns. Thank you so much. A great place to end it. I would like to thank Sasha. I would like to thank everyone who donated so generously. I would like to thank everybody who tuned in tonight and supported the show in any way. And I will be back on Friday with a special show with Thomas Sewell. And I'll be back on Sunday for a film review. I want to thank you all. Thank you to all those who supported. And if you wish to donate when I am not online and you're watching this on replay, you can do so through Entropy or Rumble at any time. Thank you to everyone who supported the show. Thank you to Sasha. Thank you to all those who tuned in. I love you all, and I'll see you same time next week for another episode of Patriotic Weekly Review. Thank you, everybody. Good night.